Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Listener question Monday, Joel. We've got five fantastic questions from listeners, and we're going to get to every single one of them this episode. This is an Ask HTM episode where we're able to provide some direct advice, some tips directly to our listeners.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, man. But yeah. Before we get to some of those listener questions, I want to let you know I got something in the mail the other day, and it was distressing on multiple fronts. It was a bill from the state of Florida. I was in Orlando visiting my mother-in-law recently. This was a bill for an unpaid toll, which... So
you've mentioned this on the show before, how you didn't have any money on you at the time.
This time, and there was no one there to take the money, and there was no way to pay. And so I was like, I blow through this. I don't know.
So this isn't a follow-up from that first instance where maybe you should have learned.
I did pay that. Literally, like, I'm getting off the exit, going to my mother-in-law's house, and there is no way to pay this toll because there's no credit card machine. And
there's no one there.
And there's literally no one there to take cash. So eventually, I guess the state of Florida gets around to, you know, sending this to me in the mail. What I thought was crazy, though, is that the actual toll itself costs $1.50. They say it's $1.59 in what they sent me, but there's a fee attached to it, I guess, because they know I'm going to pay with a credit card and they have to, you know, compensate for those fees somehow, of $2.50. And so, yeah, basically the total I'm paying them is just over $4. But it just made me think, like, how much goes into sending me this bill? There's postage, there's like printing, there's, you know, letter costs, there's all these costs that go into sending me this bill for $4. It felt like a poorly run operation. And I don't mind paying the tolls. I realize that's how the state of Florida, in Orlando in particular, gets a lot of its revenue to keep its roadways like in good condition.
That's how they pay for the turnpike, man. That's how they keep the alligators off of the roads.
Which I'm cool, man. And I don't want to be like running over alligators on my trip down there. But yeah, it all felt a little goofy to me to get this in the mail. And I feel like next time, man, they should just make it easier to pay when you're driving through there.
Or so here's the thing. You're supposed to pay, but what if you said nobody's there? If you don't have exact change, what do you do?
I mean, one time that happened to me, I didn't have the money, and they basically take down your information and they say they're going to bill you later.
Yeah.
And so they send you a bill in the mail. Then.
And that's fine if there's somebody there. But if there's nobody there,
right.
And like, are you supposed to just like, I mean, so I was going to say, in my case, I always keep a 20 in my wallet. Like, I always keep that, you know, a spare 20 kind of tucked back there. I oftentimes even forget that it's there when I do need it, which is a little...
Like, I don't have any cash. And you're like, wait, I do.
Yeah, I'll think about it later in the day. But even for me, that 20 wouldn't have helped, I guess, in this situation, unless I would have been willing to drop the whole 20 in there, which obviously you ended up paying $4, you know, in some sense. I would rather do that than drop a whole 20, right?
Yeah, I don't know if the system even works like that. If you could stick in a 20 and it would actually work.
If it gave you change, then I'd be fine with that.
Yeah.
Except I wouldn't want like $18.50 in quarters. It's like, did you ever go to like the arcade like as a kid and they got the change machines, put in a, you know, $1 bill, $5 bill, and it just spits out quarters?
They need that.
That's
what they need, yeah. But they don't have that and nobody present. So I paid it, but I felt like it was unfair, but I don't know who to complain to, and that would just waste more of my time.
Dude, I will say, though, in general, I feel like I'm a fan of tolls on roads, because if you're trying to pay for, like, that stretch of road, like, what better way than to bill the people who use it? You know what I'm saying?
I completely agree. Yeah.
I don't like how it slows you down. Like, that kind of sucks.
If you live there, but though, and otherwise, you've got the Sun Pass or whatever,
then
it's probably pretty easy. You're just kind of used to it by now. But for visitors who don't come often,
they're sticking it to you, dog.
It can be a little frustrating, although I don't mind. Like, I agree. I think it is probably the most efficient way to pay for roads. And especially now that EVs are proliferating, like, you know, and you can't get gas tax out of those people, you got to find a way to do it somehow, and that's a good way of doing it.
Yeah, I guess it's always worth keeping maybe a handful of quarters in the console, in the coin tray.
Yeah, all right. But yeah, for tolls in Florida and for Aldi shopping carts. All right, let's keep going, Matt. Let's mention the beer that we're having on today's show. This one is called Barrel Farm. It's by Monday Night Brewing, and yeah, our fridge down here in our little, basement studio broke, so we had to just snag whatever was in your refrigerator upstairs in your actual house. And so, yeah, we'll drink this one, let everyone know how it is at the end of the episode, and hopefully we'll get that refrigerator repaired soon.
The part's on the way. And although I got this for us for the specific show, so we bought two of them, one for me and Kate, one for me and you.
There we go.
That's how much I like this beer, because I've had this one before. We just haven't had it yet on the show, but we'll get to what we think about it at the end of the episode.
No doubt. But for now, let's get on to listener questions. For anyone out there who has a question they want to submit for Matt and I to be on an upcoming episode, just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there for you to be able to submit your audio file so that we can take it on a future Ask HTM episode. And Matt, let's get to the first one for today. This one's about how you go about getting a mortgage when your credit's not so great.
Hey, money friends. This is Megan from Alaska. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about mortgage or home buying options for people with less than stellar credit. I had a rather unfortunate situation with my ex-husband, and he stopped paying a mutually owned debt, which then caused my credit score to plummet. However, I recognize that when looking at housing, it makes a lot more sense to purchase a house and pay the mortgage than it does to rent. It seems to be less money, you get more bang for your buck, etc. However, with my credit score being pretty trashed, it seems as though getting a mortgage might be unattainable. Is my only option to wait it out and improve my credit score, or are there options for people like me? Thank you so much.
Megan, thanks for your question. And there are options for someone like you, and we'll get to those here as we answer your question. But first off, we're sorry to hear that your ex-husband's poor handling of your mutual credit hurt you. But let's talk about kind of rebounding from that, right? Let's talk about rebuilding your credit score. And so first of all, please be careful dealing with any company who says that they can rocket your score back into solid range for a fee.
We're going to do to your credit score what Dogecoin did recently.
To the moon, baby.
That's the promise.
A lot of these companies, what they offer, like, it's not totally legit. It's a shady practice, and oftentimes doesn't work. It's better to work on raising your credit score yourself. And so we talked about rebuilding a rough credit score back in episode 113. We talked about it in detail. But the most important things to do are to pay every account in full and on time. Make sure that you're prioritizing paying down high credit card balances in order to lower that utilization rate. Keeping your credit lines open, and then also not opening new lines for the time being. Obviously, this is kind of general advice for anyone out there who's looking to rebuild their credit score. And I'm guessing, Megan, that you're probably doing these things, because it sounds like the way that your score was negatively impacted was specifically due to your husband.
Yeah, but really the DIY route when it comes to rebuilding your credit score is the way to go, not trusting that somebody else is going to be able to do you a solid and help you out in that regard.
For a fee.
Exactly, for a large fee.
Yeah. And I'm not just going to do you a favor. It's like, hey, by the way, let's take care of your credit for you.
On the house.
Yeah.
but even with like a low credit score, you can still qualify for a mortgage, Megan. Typically, if you have a credit score around 500, which is really low, you might qualify for an FHA loan where you have to put roughly 10% down on that home purchase. If your score is a little bit higher, let's say it's 580 or higher than that, you could even qualify for a mortgage that only requires a down payment of 3.5%. And that sounds nice, right? It's like, oh, cool, I can get
3.5%
get into a house with like not having to pay much down.
I can buy 5 houses right now.
But yeah, you're not going to be getting the most competitive interest rates compared to a conventional loan where you're putting down 20%. And then don't forget too to factor in FHA mortgage insurance costs. Like both there's an upfront premium and the annual premiums too. It's just not an ideal product. The costs are going to be higher, and there's a reason for it, right? The reason is because they're lending to someone who has a credit score that isn't so hot. And so while you might find a lender that's willing to give you an FHA loan, it doesn't mean that it's going to be with the most favorable terms.
Yeah, those FHA loans, those other non-conforming loans aren't great. But Megan, you know, another option you may have heard about is going with a lender who does manual underwriting. And this is where they manually look at your finances, everything from your payment histories to the paying your utilities on time. And they don't rely on your credit score. And I don't personally think I know anyone who's done this because it is extremely rare.
Me neither. Never met anybody.
Yeah,
did the manual underwriting thing.
Exactly. But, you know, something worth pointing out, though, is that manual underwriting, it only works if you have no credit score. Like if you literally have never had a credit card, no student loans, nothing. If you have a low credit score like you have, Megan, then finding a lender who does manual underwriting is not going to necessarily help your situation. Going with a lender who does manual underwriting will only help if you're kind of more of a on the extreme edge of personal finances and, you know, you've basically said no to credit. That's not what we recommend, because obviously having a good credit score impacts so many different areas in your finances. But for those out there who are in that situation, you also too have an option.
That's right. If you have shunned the credit score completely, that is really the only option you have, yeah, is to go the manual underwriting way. But yeah, like Megan, at the end of your question, you said, should I just wait? Is that the best option for me? And, you know, just because you might be able to qualify for a mortgage doesn't mean that that's the best move for you right now. It might be worth not buying a house right now because of the bad credit score. And plus, at the same time, lending standards have gotten tighter over the past year. You might find it even harder to get a loan these days. Owning a home, I think, is a great goal, but renting might make the most sense for you for the next year or two while you're working hard to rebuild that score on your own. And not only should you focus on building up that credit score, but you should also prioritize saving more money in order to make a bigger down payment. That is another thing that's going to help you get the best terms as your credit score rebuilds, as you have more cash in the bank. You know, maybe you even get to the point where you've got 20% to put down. You can get that conventional loan with the best possible terms, putting you in the best possible position to be able to afford that home. So yeah, waiting is probably the best idea, even though there are potential options for you out there.
And too, by the time you get that nice huge down payment saved up, you're ready to buy, the housing market bubble will have popped. Then you can come in, scoop up a deal. I'm just joking. I'm not predicting a housing crash, but you never know.
You never know. I wouldn't be waiting for that, though.
Yeah.
Mostly be waiting for the savings and the credit score.
Yes.
But all right, we got more questions to get to, including, is there ever a good reason to take out a loan from your 401k? We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back from the break, and let's hear a question from a listener who is thinking about borrowing from herself.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Rachel from San Jose, California. Really love listening to your show and getting insights on how I can reach financial independence. I'm 28 and I'm going to be relocating to Colorado for work, and I'm planning on purchasing my first home, hopefully around $500,000. Ideally, I'd like to put 20% down to avoid PMI, and I was considering taking a loan from my 401k so I don't have to dip into my savings too much. I invested early in my 401k, so I have a pretty healthy balance in my account, and I figure since I'm still relatively young, I can rebound on my investments. Since I will have over 50K in my 401k to invest after I take out the loan, I also do invest in my HSA and other various accounts like my Roth IRA. I do plan on staying with my employer for some time, so paying this back should not be an issue. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, since I do hear different things about taking a loan from your 401k and, you know, anything else I should consider. Again, really love listening to your show, and I hope you guys are able to help me with my question. Thanks.
All right, Matt, lots to cover here. I feel like a 401k loan is one of those hotly debated topics in the personal finance community. Oh. Some people are going to be like, sure, go for it, not a big deal. And other people will be like, never, ever touch your 401k.
It's the nuclear option.
Exactly.
I've heard it referred to, yeah, as that.
And we're somewhere in the middle, and we'll talk about that here.
We try to be reasonable. That's our whole thing here.
That's our attempt. It works at least half the time. but yeah, Rachel, I love that you're going to be putting 20% down on your home purchase, as we just talked about in answer to Megan's question. We love that. Like, that puts you in the best position, and it's especially tough in much of Colorado. It's gotten a lot more expensive to buy a home in Colorado, Matt, these days. And I mean, everywhere, but Colorado is one of those super hot spots. So congrats on saving up so much money. Also too, it sounds like you're really doing a great job with your investments overall. You've got the 401k, the HSA, and an IRA. It's kind of that sweet trifecta of yeah, retirement savings, which is great. And yeah, so let's talk about 401k loans just a little bit more. They're not ideal, and many people use them in a way that puts them in even more difficult financial circumstances. And one of the biggest problems with a 401k loan is if you lose your job, you'll have to pay that money back quickly, or you're going to be forced to pay tax and an additional penalty on the money you borrowed. So a 401k loan can really sink people if they don't use them properly. A 401k shouldn't be treated as a piggy bank to grab money from for random uses, and that's how a lot of people view those loans. We're definitely against using them in that way.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why many folks in the personal finance community, they suggest avoiding them at all costs. But we feel that a 401k loan could also be done well. We think it could work. And so that's what we'll talk about now. Specifically, Rachel, if you decide to take a loan from your 401k, we feel that it should be an amount that you can pay off within 1 to 2 years. The company you have your investments with might offer you, let's say, like a 5-year payback period. But like, we wouldn't recommend that you take that long. We want you to get that money back in quickly. And that's partially because the money that you borrow, it won't be growing in, you know, for you in the market. And the quicker you can pay it back, then the faster that money is going to get back to working for you again. But you also want to prioritize the payback just in case an unexpected job loss were to occur. You know, you said that you liked your job and you're not expecting to leave anytime soon. But that's also a two-way street. Hopefully, I'm sure you do a great job, but if your employer is looking to maybe downsize, you could be on the chopping block.
I doubt Rachel's on the chopping block.
Not
Come
her.
On.
Yeah, Rachel sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But the good news, though, is that recent law changes give you more time to pay that money back if you did lose your job. And so now you can wait until you file taxes the year after you withdraw that money. So that's the good news. But the bad news is that if you lose your job, it's probably going to be more difficult to pay that money back.
It becomes harder to pay anything without recurring income from work, right? And so, yeah, Matt, I agree with you. I think there are some pros to taking the 401k loan compared to some of the other methods you might attempt to get that money. But one of the biggest dangers, I think, is that your attitude can change towards money that's meant for retirement. You shouldn't use your 401k to pad your lifestyle, and that's how some people use it. It's not a piggy bank, right? And tapping it for things that your emergency fund should cover is something that scares us. I think that's what we don't want to give this blanket, like 401k loans, they're great, go for it, because there are a lot of people who might hear that and they say, cool, I'm going to tap mine to pay for that Maui vacation. But you can't afford it because rental cars are really expensive.
we talked about that a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Plus, it sounds like you do have enough in savings right now to cover the 20% down payment. It's currently sitting in your savings account. That's what it sounded like when you posed the question. So consider using the money that you already have to hit that 20% down mark and then work to build up your savings again instead of going the 401k loan route. Even though taking out this 401k loan is for a decent reason, right? You're building up your down payment. You're trying to avoid that monthly fee of PMI. If that's the only option you have available to you, we would say go for it because it makes the most financial sense. But it's still ideal to use money that you already have on hand. That's what that should be there for. And then you can build that back up in the months to come after you close on your house.
Yeah, that's right, man. I think using that money for a down payment on a house, on an appreciating asset, might be one of the only instances that we would recommend for folks to use that. But don't use one of those for something that depreciates, like buying a Tesla, like Joel's been talking about here recently.
No, I haven't.
Just kidding.
I want the Rivian truck. You know that.
No, you want the V-Dub.
I want both.
ID van that's going to come out in a few years, right?
I probably won't get either, but yeah. You know, part of me wants both.
You can always hope. You can always dream. But Rachel, you know, if I was in your situation, like, I would honestly see this as a challenge to try to find a place that's going to cost maybe less than what you're currently looking to spend. I think there's a good chance that you're going to be able to find a good spot. I think there's plenty of great houses in Colorado that'll cost less than $500,000. There's a chance maybe that you're used to seeing those San Jose home prices, you know, upwards of $1 million. And it just feels like you're getting just this insane steal in Colorado for the space. But the thing is, like, do you really need that much house or do you just want it? You know, just because you had in your mind that you're going to spend this much doesn't necessarily mean that you have to pay the average home cost amount in Colorado. And so we'd recommend that you continue saving like crazy, right? Try to find other ways to cut back as you just keep socking away more money into your savings for that down payment. And then just try not to touch that 401k at all, you know? Imagine if you'd taken this money out last spring after the market had tanked. You would have missed out on some serious gains within your retirement account. So leave it all invested and keep it growing if possible. We feel that that is the best option here.
Yep. Option one, the by far and away best option, use cash you have on hand. 401k loan, at least in Rachel's situation, isn't the worst idea though, even though it is a terrible idea for lots of people.
Totally.
All right, let's move on to the next question though, Matt. This one is maybe the best question we've ever gotten, and mostly because of this voice effect.
This is Cyber Dude. After listening to your show, I realized I need to get serious about saving and investing. I'm in my mid-50s, my salary is mid-60s, and I'm signing up for my company's HSA and 401k, since I recently started working there. I have around $20,000 in an IRA, and $15,000 in my checking account. Condos in my neighborhood start at around $300,000. At this point, should I go all in on saving for retirement or a down payment? What are my best options for doing so? I'd like to keep some of my cash semi-liquid for emergencies. I could get a one-month CD with my bank at 0.02%. The past decade was really hard on me financially, and I'm trying to turn that around. Thank you.
Joel, what do you think about the cyber voice, the cyber dude?
I didn't know we were going to get questions from robots about personal finance, but I'm glad we did.
This is my favorite question of all time. I love the robot voice. And it's worth mentioning, he wanted to send in a question, but he didn't want to use his actual voice because he has family members who listen to the show, and so he didn't want to incriminate himself, I guess.
No one will know who you are now, Simon.
Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Kind of anonymous, yep. Like witness protection, you know, kind of sitting there in the shadows with a voice, with the voice changer thing. But cyber dude, you know, we're sorry that the last decade has been a tough one for you financially, but you're asking the right questions. You're heading in the right direction, and we love that getting serious means investing in your company's retirement plan and an HSA. That's awesome. Just make sure that you are actually investing within that HSA, not just saving money in it, treating it like a savings account. And we'll talk more about that here in a little bit.
Yeah, but CyberDude, you are already on the right track. You've still got hopefully 15 good years to be earning, saving, and investing before you're likely going to want to quit working, or at least stop working full time. Like a lot of people, you know, get to that age, into like right around 70. And some people want to bag work altogether, but other people say, you know what? I want to work part time, one for the income and one, like, it's something to do. Like work gives us meaningful rewards that aren't monetary. And so, yeah, that might be the best move for you because work provides a lot of satisfaction. But we'd suggest planning to work until around age 70 and then delaying Social Security until then as well. For most people, there's just no better guaranteed return than waiting to take Social Security. So I would say make that a goal of yours. And if you want to know specifically for your situation when the best time to take your Social Security is, there is actually a free calculator that you can use at opensocialsecurity.com. There's a guy who just completely nerds out on Social Security so hard, and he's made this just amazing calculator trying to, you know, basically have all the inputs that he can think of that would affect your situation, and he makes it available for free. So we'll link to that in our show notes.
That'll be us nerding out on Social Security in like 40 years.
That's right.
And so let's go ahead and get to what he's specifically asking about here, the condo. CyberDude is wondering if he should buy that condo or invest more of his money. And if we boil this question down, you know, you're wondering if you should buy an asset with the funds that you've got or if you should invest them. And so having, you know, that asset might be helpful, having that condo. It'll give you a place to live with a fixed cost, which is great. But we would rather see you rent a modest place and then continue to invest at a higher clip. So if you put your money, say, in a total stock market fund, it will, on average, offer you a much better rate of return than what you're going to see with your condo. And similar to what we said earlier, the key here is to actually invest that money, not just spend it. I think sometimes when you purchase an asset that requires money, right, like your condo, that value is going to grow because you've kind of set up this framework. You've got these payments going towards it, as opposed to maybe just extra money that's sitting there in your checking account. Make sure that you're actually being proactive and diligent with those funds to make sure that you are getting those dollars invested.
Yeah, if you're just renting a modest place and spending the difference that you should be investing, then you're not going to make up any ground when it comes to your investments. And two, Matt, yeah, investing more of your money and not sinking that into a condo is going to be the best move typically, you know, over the next 15 years from a return standpoint, right? From just purely looking at the numbers.
Yes.
But it's also worth considering whether owning a place is just a really high goal of cyber dudes. sorry, it's funny.
I keep thinking cyber truck. Every time you say cyber dude as well, like it makes me think of the cyber truck, and I just picture this metallic dude that's all
like
shiny.
A transformer or something like that? Yeah. But like, yeah, I feel like if he's going to gain a lot of satisfaction and some of that emotional peace of mind by having his own place, if it's really important to him to kind of have his own home and to not be a renter, then I would say don't completely discount the idea of buying a condo at some point. But it really is going to be, I think, the best move for him numerically over the next 15 years is to, you know, rent someplace that's inexpensive. We've talked about that before too. Rent prices have actually kind of dropped off a bit. Home prices have just continued to skyrocket. If you rent a modest place, you're going to have a lower monthly payment. That condo isn't going to be eating up some of your additional money as you have to make repairs because the landlord's going to do that for you, you're going to have more freedom, more money to be able to maximize some of those investment accounts that you have at your disposal.
That's right, dude. Yeah. So get that IRA fired back up in addition to the HSA and the workplace retirement account that you have there. And with that, you'll be stashing away tons of money for your future. And by the way, you mentioned CDs as well. Don't worry about that. Just keep your liquid cash in an online savings account with one of our favorite banks like Ally, CIT, or Discover. You'll get paid even more on that money than what your bank is offering there within a CD. But it is wise, of course, to keep some of that money on hand in case of an emergency. You don't want to completely drain your account.
CyberDude, we're pulling for you, and best of luck as you ramp up that investing for your retirement. You still got plenty of time, man. You got plenty of runway, so make it happen. All right, Matt, we got a couple more questions to get to, including an insightful question about international investing. We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back from the break, and we're going to get to that question about investing in international funds. But first, let's take a question about the best retirement account of all time, the HSA, the Health Savings Account.
Hi, guys. My name's Cam. I'm from New York. I'm a 27-year-old Marine Corps veteran with access to 100% complete health coverage through the Veteran Affairs Office for life. I am also single with no dependents and in good health, so don't see the doctor regularly at all. I recently started a new job that offers a high deductible health plan and HSA with an annual $500 employer contribution. This plan cost me about $1,500 annually in pre-tax payroll deductions. I currently max out my Roth IRA as well as contribute 8% to my company's 401k plan, which is the max employer match. I also have an individual investment account I contribute to. My question is it worth paying for the high deductible health plan in order to receive the $500 employer match, even though I never intend on utilizing that healthcare? My goal is to use the HSA as an additional retirement account and lower my yearly taxable income. However, I do not intend on contributing any money to the HSA myself. It seems as though I would be better suited canceling the employer health plan as I receive my healthcare through the VA and perhaps invest the $1,500 in my individual investment account rather than pay for coverage that I don't intend to use just to receive the employer's $500 contribution. Let me know your thoughts. Thanks.
Cam, love this question. HSAs are such a good account, and I love that you have access to one, but you're in a really interesting position that most people are not in. And yeah, we'll talk about whether or not you should be participating. But first, let's kind of do a quick primer on health savings accounts for everyone else. Matt, you and I did a deep dive on HSAs a while back on the show. We'll link to that episode in the show notes for people who want the super nerdy deep dive. But HSAs are basically tied with Roth IRAs as our favorite retirement account. They're both just superbly wonderful. And HSAs are truly incredible because they have a triple tax advantage status. And that means that you don't pay tax on the money that you put into your HSA. You also don't pay tax on the earnings, which means you should be investing that money. And you won't pay tax when you withdraw the money from that HSA if spent on qualified health expenses. And most people use HSAs, we would say, improperly. They use HSAs to spend for current year health expenses. But we think that they're best used when you can invest that money and not tap it for decades to come. And so, Cam, it sounds like that's the way you're thinking about this HSA. And so, yeah, approaching the HSA from that strategy, that sort of long-term, open the HSA, continue to fund it, invest inside of it, and grow just this massive nest egg for retirement inside of that account, we would say that's the way to go.
Yeah, that's the right approach. And I think sometimes folks can fall into thinking about their HSA sort of like they think about FSAs, which are flexible spending accounts, where if you don't use it, you lose it. And that is not the case with HSAs. HSAs, you can grow for years upon years.
Well, so I think that's partly a function of the name, Matt. Don't you agree? Like, it's called the Health Savings Account, and I think it should actually be renamed into the Health Investment Account, like the HIA. Like, I think that would better serve people. That would make them think and know and realize that they can actually be investing inside of this as opposed to just saving it and paying for this year's medical expenses, which is, you know, not a terrible way to use it. You're still getting a tax benefit, but not nearly as good of a tax benefit.
It's not nearly as advantageous, but that probably speaks to why this account was created in the first place, which which is to pay for health expenses. It's just that you have the ability to also use it as an investment vehicle, right? But Cam, you know, just because you have access to one, to an HSA, you know, does that mean that you should use it? In almost all cases, we would suggest that listeners with access to an HSA through their job contribute to that HSA because of all the, you know, the reasons that you just mentioned. But, you know, Joel, Cam, he's in a slightly different position. It's essentially going to cost him $1,000 a year to have that HSA, which is that's a really steep cost. You know, like I wouldn't pay $1,500 in order to snag that $500. It's just a bad deal. But I'm guessing it's probably a great deal for everyone else who works there at his company. It's just that when you get that sweet free healthcare for life, since Cam has served in the Marines, that's just not an expense that he needs to foot anymore. And also, Cam, yeah, thanks for your service, by the way.
Totally, Matt, and I agree. I'm sure Cam's coworkers are thrilled that they have access to this HSA that their employer partially funds. Yeah. I mean, that's a sweet position to be
in. He should be the biggest advocate for the HSA, even though he can't participate, or, you know, even though he's not going to participate himself.
Yeah, and so, yeah, let's get to that. Basically, you said that you're not planning on contributing more money to that HSA either. Even if you were, the cost of the high deductible healthcare plan would still make this a bad value proposition. And Matt, that's like what you just said. The fee is essentially exorbitant. That money invested in the HSA, it does have the triple tax advantage, but that's nothing compared to what we can essentially call a $1,000 fee that you're being charged to invest in that way. I don't even like hearing about investment fees that are, you know, 0.5% or 0.75%. And this is effectively like a 200% fee. So yeah, we would say like for everyone else who works there, that it probably makes sense. But you should be ditching the employer healthcare plan from your life and avoiding the HSA because of that wonderfully free healthcare plan that you've got. So yeah, although it's tempting because we talk up HSAs a lot here, it just doesn't make sense for your specific situation.
That's right. And, you know, one last thing, too, that we wanted to mention, Cam, you know, depending on your investing goals and when you need the money, it also might make sense for you to contribute more money to your 401k instead of more into that individual brokerage account that you mentioned. If you're investing for a big purchase, say, for instance, like a home, and you intend to tap some of that money in the next 5 to 10 years, you're probably going to be better served if you put that into your individual brokerage account. But if this is money that you won't need until decades down the road, then we would recommend that you stash more into your 401k in order to snag that extra tax advantage. It all depends on what you want to do with that money.
No doubt. All right. Well, Cam, best of luck to you as you move forward. Sorry you can't take advantage of the HSA, but in this case, it doesn't make sense. And all right, Matt, let's get to our last question for this episode. This one is essentially calling us out for something that we leave out of our investing portfolio.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Kurt in Temecula, California. I really enjoy the show. I especially liked your episode where you guys discussed how you guys personally invest. I just had one question about that. I've always been a fan of, like you guys, index funds for their cost, but I also have international index funds, and I noticed neither of you guys mentioned that in your portfolio. I've always felt that this is a good way to diversify and get some of the economic growth outside the United States. For example, I have the Fidelity Zero Fund, international fund. About 20% of my portfolio on that. So I just was wondering if that was what you felt about international funds and why you guys don't have any. Thanks.
All right, Kurt, that is an awesome question. And we thought that some astute observer might bring this up after that episode. And yeah. Kurt is that astute dude.
He sure is. And smart question.
We actually talked about that back in episode 341. That's where we talked about how it is that we invest our money. So if you haven't listened to that one, you can listen back. But Kurt, you know, we're not against investing internationally. You said that you've got around 20% of your investments in a no-cost international index fund. And that's great. That Fidelity fund in particular is a great choice. Vanguard's VGTSX is another low-cost international stock fund. And Vanguard also offers a total world stock market fund that's also dirt cheap, which goes by VTWAX or VTWAX. All these fun acronyms. And those are all worthwhile spots for you to consider investing some of your money. And that last fund, too, specifically that we mentioned, like that could easily be the only fund you hold since it puts your money in US funds, it puts your money in emerging markets, European markets, the whole world. It's a global fund. And there are certainly good reasons to have more of your investment dollars going into markets besides the US. It's not a terrible idea, but there are reasons why we don't do that.
Okay. Yeah, you just gave some good reasons for doing so. And I think there are a
pros
lot
and cons
of smart investors who would, you know, say that they would disagree with us, or they would say that, you know, any smart investor should have more international exposure. And I understand that argument. But so why in the world don't we have that international stock exposure? Well, there are a few reasons. Some might call it home country bias, a belief, to at least to a certain extent, that the United States has a superior economic engine driving progress, and so there's less of a reason to invest overseas. Past performance actually demonstrates this. International funds have, you know, vastly underperformed the S&P 500 over the last decade, although that's not necessarily indicative of what's going to happen in the future, right?
Always true.
Yeah. Another reason is that in the past, international funds used to be more expensive. It used to be that costs on international funds were higher than U.S. total stock market funds, and that extra cost was something that we weren't willing to submit to, essentially. And Kurt is living proof, Matt, that that's not the case anymore. The costs on those funds have come down wildly in recent years. But there are also a couple of other reasons. When you invest internationally, you do run the risk of investing in markets that might have weaker regulation and bigger currency fluctuations too. Those are reasons that we don't prioritize it. But there's actually one really, really big reason why we've basically stayed away from international funds, at least until this point.
Yeah, the main reason we're not investing in the different international funds is that a vast majority of U.S. companies that we hold in our U.S. index funds have massive international exposure already. So many of those companies do such a large chunk of business overseas that we believe it's not as important to own international funds as others might suggest. In fact, almost half of the revenue of companies in the S&P 500 comes from outside of the United States.
Makes me think about my visit to China, Matt. You know how many KFCs they've got over there? It's crazy. Like KFC, I think, has more
KFC,
locations
McDonald's
in China than they do in the United States.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me, I guess. But that being said, you know, it seems as though there are articles written every other week about the need to own international stocks for diversification. And again, to be clear, we're not against others doing so, and we might even, you know, do more international investing in the future as well. But for the time being, we feel that the U.S. total stock market index funds or the S&P 500 funds provide enough international diversification without the additional risk of owning international funds. Again, that's where we stand now. That might change in the coming decades, you know? Like, I'm curious to see where we stand on this, Joel, in 20, 30 years as the different economies of other major countries, as they evolve, as they change, and as our economy here in the U.S., as it changes as well.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, even some of the quote-unquote downsides that I mentioned, you know, partially in the answer to Kurt's question, have gone by the wayside, some of them, right? Like the additional expense of investing internationally is not really a thing anymore. And so, yeah, as the reasons begin to tick away to, you know, keep your money in like a U.S. total stock market fund in favor of at least some exposure to some of those international index funds, it does get on my radar in a more significant way. And I could see myself at some point owning some international index funds, but just don't yet.
Yeah, so Kurt, hopefully that answers your question, and happy investing to you. Joel, let's shift gears. Let's get back to the beer that you and I shared on this episode. You and I enjoyed a Barrel Farm, and this is their Mixed Culture Farmhouse Sour Ale, and this is blend number 2. I've had blend number 1. It was delicious. What did you think about number 2?
Oh my gosh, dude, this was so good. I felt like I was tasting peaches when I was drinking this. Definitely had a peach vibe, even though there were no peaches like made in it.
Yeah.
That's what I love about beers. Like when you taste certain fruits in an IPA and you could swear that there was like blood oranges or something like that in it, but there weren't, because it's just the flavor of the hops coming through. And yeah, the mixed culture going on in this beer created just some really, really interesting tastes. It was light, slightly funky, nicely tart. And I got to say, this was incredibly delicious. Another winner from the folks over at Monday Night Garage.
Yeah, poured a nice light golden color. It's pretty fizzy, and I totally agree with you. Like peaches, almost like apricot fruit as well, but it had like this just nice light, but at the same time, woody and barrel nature, like backbone to the beer. And of course, a nice level of acidity. Like any sour that's been barrel aged and is bringing the acidity, dude, I can't help but to love that style of beer. Like it convinces me that this is like a health drink, you know? Like like as I drink this, it's like
kombucha,
okay,
or something.
Yes, yeah, for real, because it's mixed culture, and so these are like live cultures. It's not unlike yogurt and how they say that it's good for your gut,
good for your tummy.
You also get that with these beers that are made from wild yeast strains, and it can make it a little unpredictable, but oh so delicious when it works. But yeah, I'm glad you and I got to share this one on the show today. And if you live near Atlanta or in Georgia and you've never had a Monday night beer, we would highly recommend their stuff, especially some of these nicer beers that they put out.
Well, they keep expanding their distribution footprint too.
Oh, so gosh, yeah, that's true.
You want to be able to get your Monday night beers in all the Southeast pretty soon, I think.
That's true.
Well, yeah, I like my beers unpredictable, just like I like my listener questions episodes. I think we had some good questions today, but that's going to do it for this episode. We really appreciate you listening, and we'll have show notes up on our website with links to some of the resources we mentioned. That's at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And you can also go to howtomoney.com/ask if you would like to send us your own listener question. We love taking these different questions. A lot of these today were about investing, but we love hearing about all the random money situations that folks find themselves in. Honestly, the more random they are, like, the better, because no two situations are the same. And so I think that's one of the things we enjoy about listener questions. So if you've been thinking about sending us a question, head over to howtomoney.com/ask, and the instructions are there. Joel, that's going to be it, buddy, for this episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.